IT businesses in Sacramento, California.
From somewhere deep in the cloud and the corners of the earth, this is the Killing It Podcast, with a focus on helping you make sense and dollars of all things IT, with your hosts, Dave Sobel, Ryan Morris, and Carl Polachuk.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 104 of the Killing It Podcast. I'm Carl. I'm here with Ryan and Dave, as always. I think everybody in the country has got decent weather except Colorado this week.
Yeah. My son lives in Denver, and I got a picture of 27 inches, not including the wind-blown berms and everything. 27 inches, and I was like, that's a reason why I don't live in Denver anymore.
I am living by the weather report. It is cracking me up. Like, every day I am checking the extended forecast now as like a moving target of, I'm trying to schedule it. Sharon and I want to go out to a nice restaurant that has this really great outdoor patio, but I need the evening to be kind of warm enough for it. So like, I'm completely watching for like, will the weather be good? And now I'm looking to like, can I slide in a bike ride? Like, when can I do that? Which days are going to be good? It's now this whole building block thing of calendar that I never did before. That it was
When I was a young kid, my dad was fascinated with the weather report. I grew up becoming fascinated with it because of him. I think weather maps are very entertaining. But I didn't ever think it was all that important. If it was raining, I was still going to go outside and play. But at some point, I became the man, and I started to care more about that than I ever did before. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. I'm one of those guys now.
Yeah, well, I live in California, so our weather is never serious. It's the ground that's serious, not the weather. But I think the best invention ever, I just want to take a minute and praise whoever invented that outdoor heater that allows you, Dave, to go outside and have a meal outside, even in March, no matter what the weather is. That's a beautiful thing.
Don't get me wrong. Those things are great. But now I have all this experience, right? And I have learned the tolerance level for the outdoor temperature and how much that can compensate for. Let me observe that those cool outdoor heaters, doesn't matter if it's 33 degrees outside. Doesn't matter. Still too warm.
Even in those situations, one side of you is really warm and the other side of you is the dark side of the moon.
Right.
And so, there's about an 80 degree difference.
And I have learned, like, I'm happily married, right? Like, one of the things you always learn these things. If one of the members of your relationship is cold, things generally go badly. Like, just a general rule. Like, if hungry or cold, things will go badly. And if you're already hungry by going out to dinner and she's cold, this is just a recipe for disaster.
Life lessons from Dave.
Exactly.
Well, alrighty, we then are brought to you this week by our friends at Ignite. Are you still using on-prem file servers and VPNs to share files with remote workers? Ignite is a business class cloud sharing solution that works more like your on-prem server than other solutions. With a security-first approach to file sharing and collaboration, Ignite offers multiple options for sharing files and collecting files from outside sources. And do it all, addressing data governance and compliance. You want to learn more? Check out ignite.com/MSP. And when you do, tell them the guys from Killing It sent you. So I will kick us off. Carl found this one, but it's just such a cool sort of description on this. A AI-driven Mayflower is going to sail across the Atlantic next year. It's an autonomous vehicle. It's going to, it was delayed. It was supposed to commemorate the 400th anniversary of the Pilgrims landing at Plymouth, but we're still going to get it. And the idea of this is an entirely autonomous ship sailing across. Carl, I'll throw it to you sort of first for a reaction. What got your interest level most on this particular one?
The first thing was that this thing was going to be completely autonomous. And when I clicked on it, I was hoping to see a Mayflower looking ship,
but a big old boat.
This is like space age catamaran that, like, okay, if that thing can't make it across the ocean unattended, nothing can, right? So but I think it's just, it's interesting because clearly with the unattended vehicle, there's other technology that's going to follow from that. If you can make it 4,000 miles across the Atlantic or whatever, I guess if you're not on the bottom of the ocean, it's only 2,000 miles, but whatever it is, that is going to be very impressive. And if you imagine that they could just build this ship larger and larger and larger until it takes cargo from one side to the other, that could be some serious changes.
See, and I buy this from an adoption curve point of view, right? I am fascinated by the idea of autonomous cars. I think it will be eventually true that you and I will ride along in the back of an autonomous Uber or et cetera. But I also believe that it will happen far sooner in the long haul over the road trucking industry, because it's not about people driving for pleasure or convenience, it's about businesses managing cost. That concept multiplied by about, I don't know, 2,000 times the capacity, when it becomes an ocean liner that ships that many vehicles at once, that the business model makes drastic sense. It is really good from you can put $1 billion of software and guidance intelligence into that thing and still make it back relatively quickly with the volume of things that you can move. I think that that's a place where it's going to happen quickly, but then it starts to spawn other very cool opportunities.
Well, I can see cool distribute the idea of, like, you know, and you can see it from, I don't know, Amazon, right? You can see the idea of their distribution centers being located outside city centers, and that being where the trucks are able to easily get in and off of, you know, high speed roads, the interstate or the autobahn or whatever it is, depending on where you are, so that piece can be fully automated, like between distribution centers, and then perhaps even switching to smaller autonomous vehicles. You know, so for example, it goes to the big trucks, go to the warehouses, which get reloaded into smaller robots, which are able to into communities. You know, you can see how this works out as it scales up. I think that, you know, there's a lot less risk. I don't know, you're kind of like intrigued by the idea of autonomous ships, right? That's a whole big space where we don't generally think of things running into one another very well.
Right.
And you don't have the same problems of autonomous vehicles in, you know, on land, because there's this big open space. Now, don't get me wrong, they do bump into one another. I'm not saying that it's that, but you can clearly define, like, these are autonomous routes and these are staffed routes. Like, it can be arbitrary, and you can just change them based on software really, really easily.
Do you have to wonder whether they would take some more risks and maybe move faster or whatever if they know that there's no human beings on board?
Hopefully, depending right. on the cargo. Like, I can see there being some cargo I do not want to go quite as fast with.
So question, what do you do about pirates? Like, you
got
See, now that's the reason why I have often said to Anissa, it doesn't matter how big the lottery is that we win one day, because I'm thinking positively, I'll never own a big ocean faring yacht, because no matter how glamorous and luxurious that is, you still have to employ guys with machine guns to protect you from the open seas, even in the 21st century. Those ships, I think, would be large enough that they would be reasonably unassailable. Living up here in the Pacific Northwest with the very large international ports, Tacoma and Seattle, there was a headline in the news a couple of years ago accompanied with a photo. It was a ship shipping ship shipping shipping ships.
And I know, I love that picture.
It was a photograph of a boat, and this thing pulled into Tacoma Harbor, and we drove over there to see this thing. My God, what an unbelievable feat of human engineering. That thing was the Empire State Building and then some, floating through the water, and it was going where they intended for it to go. I was blown away by that. If you could take that and automate it, now we're cooking with gas.
So serious, I can solve the pirate problem. Electrified fences and remove the oxygen from the storage area. And I say that flippantly to make it to be funny, but I will also say, like, if it was of an entirely automated ship, my choice of security mechanisms can be very different, right? I can make the ship inhospitable to humans. Like, that is one solution to...
It could be totally sealed. And like,
right. I could totally well seal it. I could make it in completely environmentally unfriendly to humans. Meaning, like, you know, you go in there and you can't breathe. You can't walk on it. Because I don't need humans to go into that space. And I could secure it by making it inaccessible in really aggressive ways.
And yeah, you know, electrifying the deck surfaces, that would keep me away from that.
Well, right. It's like, I mean, a thin layer of water and electrify it. I mean,
the pirates just send in robots. I mean, you know.
We have robots attacking robots, and we have the whole other area of combat.
I've seen that movie, and I'm there for it. Give me my popcorn.
I just want to have the film crew that's got the drones flying around, you know, filming the movie. So, but anyway,
I want to have automated drones flying around watching the automated pirates attack the automated ship.
And by the way, if it all works out okay, Dave's model will get you closer and closer to the day where that drone slash robot will bring the burrito to my house.
Exactly. Sorted. I have solved our problem. I think
now we have a three-way bet. All right, enough of that. So our second topic, we sort of delayed talking about this only because we weren't entirely sure that it was a good news story, but I've decided, it's worth bringing up, and that is non-fungible tokens. So I'm sure you've heard by now of these non-fungible tokens artwork, which is basically original artwork declared through Bitcoin or through the Ethereum or whatever it is, but basically blockchain is used to determine that you own the one original copy of artwork, and then it becomes rare and sellable and so forth. And really, this is a way for Bitcoin billionaires to keep their money in something that they think has value and avoid taxes. Well, now the question is, an article from Wired Magazine, if you keep this Bitcoin documentation in some place where the public can get to it, don't you create a permanent record that the government can use to tax you anyway? So we may be defeating the goal of avoiding taxes by having these. Does anybody care?
Well, all right. So I'm gonna wait, because I struggle with the NFT thing, right? Because part of me is inclined to just be incredibly dismissive of the whole thing, right? Because it's just like, this just reeks of ridiculousness. Because at some level, you kind of go, the whole point of digital assets is the ability to replicate them. A digital copy of something else is an exact copy, right? But I will buy into the idea that there is a certain value in unique things, owning things. And but let's observe that there are a number of asset classes in the world that we simply as humans have determined have value. Art intrinsically may not have value, right? Like the Mona Lisa, we have agreed, has incredible value. But from a physical perspective, it is canvas and paint, right? And you can have a copy of the Mona Lisa, but the one thing has value. And I can see how we would want a system in the digital world that has value to digital things. So I can see the value of all of this. But I will definitely say that right now it still feels like this just ridiculous space of craziness where people are trying to justify its own existence by doing it within its own community. Like the buyers are the crypto people who are buying it and driving it. Like, but I don't want to be totally dismissive of the core idea, because it is entirely arbitrary. Like, we've decided gold has value, right? It's a metal. We could, right. Like, there's arbitrariness to the way that we determine value. And so it's okay to fundamentally extend that to digital assets, that arbitrariness.
Well, and see, this is the thing, right? I will answer your second question first, Carl, because the reason I think this is newsworthy is that it is a use case for the undeniable accuracy of that crypto track of ownership, additive transference, etc., right? The point and purpose of crypto is not to have a currency or to create art. It is to create an absolutely undeniable, unassailable digital record of things. Now, if Bitcoin is a use case for that technology, and then, you know, as manufacturers in the technology industry are getting into the trustworthiness of their supply chains to be able to identify to the component level the origin and transit path of every single thing that goes into a device that they sell. Okay, again, the digital record is interesting. Well, maybe art is just another use case for that, proving out that this is an unassailable thing. Now, to your point, Dave, everything is arbitrary, which kind of means that this is a perfect use case for that. It's only valuable because somebody said so, and then other people agreed with them. But then the ultimate question is, if you have a copy and I have a copy and you have a copy and every human on the planet has one, can I actually go back in and check the logs and identify the one true original version? If I can, I kind of trust the crypto thing.
And it kind of falls ultimately into the category of, do you care or not care? Because if you care, it has value. And if you don't, it doesn't. I, for one, I don't wear jewelry. I don't have. So to me, things like gold and silver and diamonds, like literally, I don't care. They don't have any value to me. I would not pay $50,000 for a piece of jewelry of any kind. I don't care what it's made out of, because I'm not interested, right? But a really nice car, I could see paying 60, 80, 100, 200,000, right?
So you also have to get into the emotional element of selling some of these things. So Carl, you're right. Like, I mean, jewelry isn't necessarily interesting, but let's go into areas where, like, baseball cards, right? Like they are printed pieces of paper that at some
level. There was one physical original or a set of originals that can be proven.
Well, except they produce a whole lot, right? So, like, I mean, right. But this is one of those areas where it's like, because there are emotional risk, like, you, there's scarcity, but there's also emotional component to the value of it. So, for example, back to even on your jewelry bit, like my wedding band has high value to me, even though it is simply a gold ring that is not particularly valuable on its own, right? There are a bunch of these. Like, this isn't a particularly expensive one that I bought, like, you know, because for exactly the same sort of reason, Carl's like, I'm not a big kind of jewelry kind of guy. But this particular one for me has a very, very high value. You can monetize things based on that. And thus there is value in the emotional connection of some of these things. For example, if I want to buy a piece of unique digital art and I be the owner of it, that may have an extraordinarily high level of value. And so there's that piece too. And what's interesting to me about this, that again, I don't feel like I fully understand yet, is this allows you to sort of systemize it and legitimize it in a trackable kind of way that is different from the from other types of buying.
I will give you a great analogy, which is Andy Warhol, right? When he first started producing his artwork, the soup cans and whatever, he was literally just cranking them out on a printing press, right? So somewhere, somehow, there is one original from which all of these other copies were made. And he was happy to make a fortune off the copies, right? Right. But somewhere somebody owns the one original, the original of all the originals. And if they can prove it, if they have that provenance, then it has tremendous value to an art collector.
Well, and so there's the art collector side and then there's the commercial side. So if you own this thing and a million people have and transmit copies of that digital artwork, there's a copyright element that you might be able to begin to collect micro payments that will eventually be very, very lucrative. So that kind of provenance testing makes a whole lot of sense. I think you won't find me buying one of these things, because I'm of the kind that says I would much rather own a photograph that I took of a painting in a museum because it reminds me of the time that I was there and the experience that I had, as opposed to the original artwork on my wall that no matter who painted it or how valuable it is, I wasn't there. So now I will say this carefully because I have a younger sister who is an actual artist. With all of the degrees and the provenance and the museum credentials to go with that stuff. And she has a very certain way of appreciating artwork in a museum environment. My way of appreciating it is I'll walk up to it, take a really cool high bit pixel depth of on my iPhone, and then I will walk away and I will edit that thing down and I will look at it on my screensaver and enjoy the daylights out of it. This very different application, but if you could now establish you own that artwork digitally and for me to put it on my screensaver, I got to pay you a fraction of a penny. I'm okay with that. And you would be okay with that too in the spirit of aggregating all of that commerce. So there
It'll be interesting to shake it out because this is the way that the value of the commerce mechanism gets shaken out. Sometimes it is, sometimes the extreme cases that will allow us to understand where the applications go. So I'm with you, Carl, that like this has reached like the point of where it's okay, I'm at least watching, I'm at least tracking. I'm not entirely bought in yet, but I see the pieces coming together in a way that makes some sense for me.
So let me just finish up this topic with my favorite story of all time, which is the Emperor's New Clothes. Right? This may end up being the Emperor's New Clothes. So
yes,
we shall see.
Exactly. And there were tulips that were sold at a certain point in history as well. So we humans, we're a persuadable lot, which leads us to our third topic here. And it's something that we've been discussing the general concept of for a while. But I am fascinated by a proven product that has just been released. So the topic is basically that Tanium and Salesforce have just announced the release of what they call IT Service Center, which is a platform for service management, remote monitoring, et cetera, et cetera. All of us who listen to our podcast conversation, this is our backyard of tools and tricks that make our trade. And a very large, very well-funded organization has just stuck a toe into our pool. I'm interested to hear what your reactions are to this.
There's another RMM on the market.
Yeah, exactly. It's another RMM.
Another RMM.
From a big company that might just do the swallow up of all of the other little ones.
Realistically, RMM has become such a commodity market, and the tools, 90% of them do 90% the same thing. So, and as Dave has pointed out, and some tool vendors are saying, hey, you know, we don't really need to do this. We're just going to integrate Microsoft's platform. So it's a weird timing, but I think the move is to try to basically gobble up a piece of a market where Salesforce says, we don't need to be the primary product. You know, we make so much money from plugins and add-ons. This is just another one of those.
So I, in my 2021 prediction series, one of my predictions was that this space would, the MSP space would get disrupted in this calendar year. I give you contender number one has entered the ring.
How will this disrupt anything? I mean, I do imagine people saying, oh, what's the cost of that? Do you think Salesforce is selling this for 98 cents instead of a dollar?
Well, so the answer is, this is why I call them a contender, not declaring any kind of victory on this, right? Because it has not played out yet. I do not know how their go-to-market is going to fully play out. I do not know the way that they're going to engage the market. However, one of my basic premises has been the all the interesting stuff happens up in the business layer. I don't know, Salesforce plays up there, right? So if Salesforce's core product is their actual Salesforce, the Salesforce CRM business management piece, and now you can bolt on this thing that for them is not necessarily a lead product, but it incorporates all of that and then just throws that all in, that feels disruptive, where this piece is an afterthought to their core business, but they know you need it, right? Like, you know you need this component. Well, and
I think that, it, to me anyway, When I think of Salesforce, I think of enterprise. I think of this. This is probably more disruptive for Remedy than it would be for a Kaseya or Continuum.
I'm much more intrigued by them in the mid-market, and I think you are probably being a little too dismissive of some of their SMB plays.
And I will vouch for that very aggressively, right? So in all of our solution provider facing work, one of the core components that we are concerned with is the CRM platform. And 5, 7, 8 years ago, there were 15 different versions that we were trying to draw data from for reporting and tracking purposes. Now there are essentially 3, of which almost all of the others have been replaced by SFDC in the SMB. That's a lot of acronyms for you right there. They are playing from the enterprise aggressively into the mid-market, and they're moving into the SMB. My reaction to this was, this is a classic Microsoft competition strategy. I didn't invent the category. I don't need to innovate the category. I have more access to end users, and I have radically more working capital / investment capital to put behind this thing than every other established player combined. I don't need to have the best one, because if I'm SFDC and I've got the ear of the CEO of 2.5 million organizations in this economy, just in North America, and I can go to all of them and say, bolt it on, I'll include it, and you don't have to pay for a separate one. And by the way, you know us, we're SFDC. Who's that little guy? Your IT department might have heard of him, but as we learned with the SolarWinds hack earlier in this season, almost all of the people outside of the IT department had never heard of their management platform. All the people with the checkbooks have heard of Salesforce. I think they might just steamroll the market.
And Carl, I'd love to hear your response to. So if I'm a new entrant, right? So my thinking here is I want to form my new solution provider, or what I envision where I'm going to be. I'm going to play in the business of making Salesforce.com work really well for my customer base. They could be SMBs. They could also be lower mid-market. But ultimately, I'm going to go in there and I'm going to be your business guy. I'm going to make sure your business works really well on the Salesforce platform. Oh, and while I'm here, I need to make sure the IT stuff works. So I'll just bolt this thing on, which they'll help me do those bits with. And I don't have to think about the infrastructure. That's the disruptive play if I'm building a solution provider of the future, because what I really care about is selling my business process stuff in the business layer on Salesforce.com.
Well, so how many people do you know in the SMB space are selling and integrating Salesforce? Because I don't think it's a very big chunk of our business. What I could see happening here is that this could open up a new bunch of markets for us to take advantage of. But again, small businesses like to do business with businesses their own size.
Oh, sure. But that's what I'm saying. I'm the small guy, and what I'm doing is I'm bringing the power of Salesforce to your small company. And I'm just going to because they have a very, very rich ecosystem of people around them.
But I could say exactly the same thing about Dynamics, and most people are not integrating Dynamics or selling it or offering it to their clients, it could be.
Yeah, well, what I found to be the interesting multiplier here is exactly as this article that we're linking to points out, it's multiplied by the work from anywhere gajillion random endpoint devices in an unsecure world. That is something that the average RMM does not do, right? For all the things that they do similar to each other, we all know that they suck with mobile device management. And if there's anything that SFDC is branded for, it is branded for individual sales humans who live out in the world and work for a very large organization or a mid-size organization. And if I can figure out all of their endpoints that don't reside in the data center or the corporate headquarters, that's a drastic expansion of your opportunity for service footprint.
I'll leave the last thought for me, my throat is Carl. There don't need to be a lot of these. There don't have to be a ton of these to start skimming off some of the best customers, the ones with the deepest pockets that are going to truly invest in the business layer. They don't need to be a mass market bit. Just a small group of them are going to start taking away some of the best customers. And that's when things got interesting, is because they start skimming away at that, systemizing it and moving down. That's the bit that I'm looking
for. Yeah, I guess I would not encourage anybody to lose any sleep tonight. I think that's a mid-market play, and it opens up customers to think that maybe they could use a smaller vendor. So maybe it's an opportunity for us, but it's certainly nothing for us to worry about.
Thus my statement of contender, I'm not declaring any, but I'm just looking at this going, ooh, I think there's disruption coming. I see one of my contenders now.
And they do have more money than all the rest of us combined. So.
And with that, we conclude episode 104 of the Killing It,
Killing It
podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to the Killing It podcast. Please share with your friends and tell everyone to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the podcast places. Join us next week and help us keep killing it in the technology business.